Hello and welcome everybody to this part of our weekly teaching where we are looking at the spiritual seasons of the year and relating those to the Torah portions and to Joshua. I've just been so blessed by this study, and it's one that I've been doing for years now, in fact, in different ways. And I tell you, if you can grab hold of some of the things that are being put together here, the calendar really just unlocks so many things. I see the Torah in such a different way. It's never dull. There's not a dull verse. And the world itself too, in a different way. It's well worth it if you can stick it out. But today I want to touch upon one of the main themes in the whole of the Torah. It's an important theme for this season, and it's one we can see in the Torah portions of Vayetze and Vayishlach. As we begin, though, we need to lay some groundwork to get some foundation pieces in place. Hopefully, this teaching will help you to see some basic elements of creation from a new perspective, including the human body and the changing temperatures as the seasons progress from heat to cold and back to heat again. I find it to be a fascinating and even inspiring discussion, and I hope you will too. So let's start with the highest view of our subject today and move down from there into more concrete, connected ideas. The theme I want to talk about is God's design for moving from truth to action. This is truly a foundational topic for us as believers. As Grant has often cautioned, it's one thing to know and to understand, but it's another to actually do something. We don't want to be just a donkey loaded with books, as Grant would say, overflowing with knowledge, but useless otherwise. If we are up in our head all the time, we might be having amazing ideas up there, but we're distracted all day with all this great thinking. And if we're distracted like that, we're useless to the world. So what's the point to that kind of life? Understanding with the mind is not the ultimate goal. Truth must be translated into practical action, or else it is better to not even know, right? We're held responsible for what we know. So it's better to not even know if we're not going to act on it. So there's a chain of events that leads from receiving new light and translating that into action. I will give it over to the degree that I understand. So, which is to say that I don't understand a lot, but I know a little bit about it. So the surprising angle here is that the rabbis say the route to action must pass through the emotions and even the lower animal instincts. We need to have passion. Passion is the key to action. So let me say that again. Passion is the key to action. So here's how it works. Picture your spirit existing right now in a place of higher vision, a place where the self-sacrificial life is obvious and easy and radiant. In that place of the spirit, evil is so obviously deadly and separating us from God that it's repulsive. And good is so clearly life and connection to God that it's simply bliss to do good. It's a place of clarity. The spirit wants to act to do good in this world, but the challenge God has given our spirits is that in order to do anything here, the spirit has to act through a body. So that's the spirit's challenge. Now, the spirit understands that it needs to get to the heart because it knows the mind is not where action is found. The spirit could try to inspire the heart directly with basically no understanding, but that fizzles out quickly. We can only act for a short time on a vague inspiration of the heart. The spirit knows it has to start with the mind, with understanding. So as we said before, understanding is not the goal, but it is the key to the heart, and the heart is the key to action. So Rabbi Zvi Freeman describes the process of inspiration leading to action like this. The mind has to first reach up and grab some of the spirit's higher vision. Then it chews on that vision until it becomes real enough that the heart can also relate to it. At that point, we say, I see it. It really is that way. When it becomes concrete enough for the heart to really get it, the heart kicks in with lasting inspiration, a great fiery energy that can run circles around the mind with its endless fritterings and musings. When we get the emotions and the lower instincts into it, there's simply no stopping us. We will burn up this body on behalf of what is energizing our emotions. And that's what we want. We want to use up this body and our resources because we're burning with a passion for what is true and right and good. We want to sacrifice these bodies for the truth, the reality that is so apparent to the spirit. That is what we are created for. So we can illustrate this great power the emotions carry with them through a negative example, the unfortunately too common problem of eating disorders. A higher percentage of women are dealing with severe eating disorders than men, but a larger percentage of men than women say that they binge eat in an unhealthy way. So this is a problem that affects both of the sexes. The fact is, though, that the especially acute problems in this area are much more common to women. It's meaningful to this discussion that these problems are more common for women. This is because women are generally more connected to their emotions than men. I mean, I know I'm stereotyping, but it's true. And women can fall under the sway of the emotions a little bit easier, which can be both good and bad. It actually helps women to follow through more with action. So as we're saying, the emotions bring a great deal of energy and power for unwavering action. In the case of an eating disorder, the woman has become convinced of some kind of lie to the point that her emotions have become engaged and fixed on a certain path of action. Even when the truth is blaring at her, even when she looks in the mirror and sees a skeleton looking back at her and she can see that she's dying, it makes no difference. If her emotions and instincts are being activated by a lie, then she will act according to the lie, and her emotions will push her to completely use up her body in service to the lie. When our emotions and instincts are deeply moved for something, even impending death won't stop us from acting in alignment with those emotions and instincts. How many famous people have been completely ruined because they couldn't stop themselves from acting on instinctual drives? So it's vital that our emotions be informed by truth rather than lies. But my point here is that there is massive power for action bound up in the emotions. And we must utilize this for good, for using up our bodies in the right ways. When the emotions and instincts jump onto a truth, when we become convinced of a truth in our hearts, we will drive our bodies to the point of death to act on that truth. Okay, so that's the general chain of transmission, mind to emotions and instincts to action. Now let's start to bring in the ideas we're aiming at here of how this chain is pictured in the human body and what in the world seasonal temperature changes have to do with any of this. Just stick with me. It'll make sense in the end here. Our bodies are described as miniature versions of all of creation. We have waters above, a realm above, which is the head, and we have waters below, which is the lower body. Now the middle section, the neck and the thoracic cavity, which contains the lungs, is like the rakia, filled with air, right? The rakia in Genesis 1 is the atmosphere that separates the waters above and below. The heart is also in this middle area, right? The heart is right here in between the lungs, which is a separating area, but it's also a connecting area, right? This area here with the lungs, it connects, but it also separates. So as we have already implied, the head, right, the world above is the seat of thinking, and the heart and the gut are the seats of emotion and instinct. There are differing ideas of exactly how this works. Some talk about the emotions being centered in the heart and some in the gut, right? So they're not quite in agreement. One ancient idea is that the intellect actually has four centers, three in the brain and one in the heart, a heart brain, which is fascinating too. That's a very ancient idea that science is just coming on to learning about. What everyone agrees on, though, what everybody agrees on, is that the intellect is chiefly centered above and in the head, and the emotions below. We need to engage the heart and the gut in order to translate truth into action. Now, action is found in the arms, right? It's found in the hands, in the arms, and it's found in the legs. Now, the arms are rooted near the heart, right? We could say our arms are rooted here, the heart is right here, and the legs are rooted near the gut, right? The pelvic cavity there. As an aside, we have here a connection to the last teaching about spiritual maturity involving deep engagement of the physical realm. As we mature, we end up engaging the physical world more and more deeply and making more physical tools available to the spirit to act through. The body is arranged with the spiritual higher at the top, and as you descend the body, you enter more and more physical and earthy realms, regions. So here we can see that by descending the body to engage the heart and the gut, we are descending to engage deeper and deeper levels of physicality. As we start thinking in this way, using clues from here and there, clues from the Exodus, clues from the covenants, clues from the progression of Genesis 1, and so on, we start making startling associations. Here, for example, we can ask ourselves, as we progress through the calendar, is there maybe a sense that we are descending the body and bringing holiness lower and lower in the body as the year progresses? Is there some kind of relationship we can find there? Is the giving of the Torah at the start of the third month a kind of filling of the mind, right, up here, but one that doesn't yet touch the heart? So questions like these never end up with simple answers. And of course, we can't ever get to the bottom of God's ways, but what an exhilarating journey such questions lead us on. Well, let's turn now to the connection to temperature, because this will lead us back to the calendar and the season we are now in. The connection to temperature is obvious and is very much a cross-cultural understanding. The upper world of the mind is cold, detached from the emotions, while the lower world of the heart and the instincts are warm. We use phrases all the time in English, like the villain is coldly calculating, or your act of kindness warmed my heart. We can even feel this in our bodies quite readily. When we are filled with strong emotions and passions, our bodies actually get hotter. These associations aren't coming from nowhere, right? There's a reason that we have this in our language. So to recap so far, the power behind consistent action is found in engaging the heart with its connections to great primal and even animal energies. There is a process for doing this engaging of the heart that starts with the mind, the intellect. The intellect is associated with coolness and the heart with warmth. Now, all of that background doesn't speak too plainly about how we actually engage the heart. So Rabbi Freeman helps a little bit with his description of the mind chewing on the light long enough until it becomes concrete enough for the heart to grasp. But we can do just a little bit better than that. Let's start by saying that Rabbi Freeman is perhaps missing something that particularly Messianic believers always seem to have near the forefront of their thinking, and that is the new covenant. This process of touching the heart doesn't begin with us. It begins with Yeshua's blood, as every step of salvation does. At Yeshua's final meal, he lifted the cup after the meal and he said, "This is my blood of the new covenant." Although we see that blood spilled at Passover, right? That's when he is crucified, is at Passover. We don't actually see it presented to the Father until Yom Kippur on this side of the calendar, the seventh month. So Yom Kippur has this special association with the new covenant, and there are more connections between the seventh month and the new covenant. Recall that as the rabbis work out Moses' trips up the mountain, they see him going up three times, each for 40 days, coming down the third and final time with the second set of tablets. And when does he come down with that second set? You guessed it. He comes down with the second set of tablets on Yom Kippur. Now, we don't read about that in the Torah, but as they work out the 40, 40, 40, couple days in between, they come out with Yom Kippur for Moses coming down the final time with the second set. This second set, this second writing of the Torah, is like the new covenant, a second covenant. So we have these strong associations with the new covenant and the fall, the special days of Tishrei that prepare us for the journey of fall and winter. In a special way, in the fall and winter, we are empowered to walk out the new covenant. And what is the core of the new covenant? So this is what we're driving at here. I will put my Torah in your gut and write it on your heart. That's what it says in Jeremiah, and it's quoted in Hebrews. That's the new covenant. I will put my Torah in your gut and write it on your heart. So this is something that God does through Yeshua, and we must walk it out. It all begins with Yeshua and his sacrifice and his blood. We don't have to begin the process of engaging the heart with truth ourselves, right? We don't have to begin that process. This is not our work, but we do have a role to play in walking it out. I think that this role that we play is what Rabbi Freeman is talking about when he says, we have to chew, right? We have to chew on the truth. You see, the real key to getting our hearts on board with truth is vision. And it is chewing and thinking and meditating that leads to deeper vision. Seeing is believing. The heart wants something concrete to see. In this season, the part we play is to do the chewing, the meditating, putting forth some time to see, right? Yeshua gets this all started, the spark going in our lower bodies. But we have a part to play, and that is to chew and to make the thing concrete for the heart to see. As we go deeper in talking about the role of vision in this process, we need to make some connections to the month we are in now, the ninth month, which is Kislev. First of all, let's note that we're really starting to feel the cold now. And what does that mean? Let's go back to the whole discussion we just had to try to answer that question. If our environment is turning cold, that means there is a spiritual push toward coldness toward God happening in this season. And we have to fight that. So thank goodness for Yeshua starting the spark in us. There's a push toward apathy toward God right now. And this pushing requires us to take action so that we don't freeze. This goes right along with the season of Hanukkah and the idea of fighting against being yoked to the dominant secular humanist culture. God is providing a spiritual environment that pushes us toward spiritual coldness. And coldness is apathy. Lack of emotional connection. And so why would God create such an environment? Why would he allow the Greeks to rise up against his people, push their Greek culture on them? The answer is that he is driving us to seek an internal heat, an internal flame. He wants us to develop an internal passion at this time of year with which we challenge and counter and fight against the external cold. So in this season, God is saying to us, make a choice. Either you embrace the gift I have already started to give you through the Messiah, the new covenant, the spark of Torah, engaging the instincts and emotions, or you don't. If you embrace it, that spark will grow within you and become a raging fire. You will need that energy and vitality to defeat the enemies I'm allowing to rise up against you now. Be like the Maccabees. If you are willing, I will give you a passion to match theirs. So what do we do to embrace this inner fire, the inner passion, so that we can be fixed on the good path in this season? We open our eyes to see what God would show us of himself in this season. Remember, the heart wants to understand rather concretely. Seeing is believing. We've said previously, however, that God is hiding himself a bit more during this time of year, right? We associated the growing darkness of this time of year with God hiding himself at this time of year. So how do we see him now? Now is the time where we need to see him. If we're going to engage the heart and step into what Yeshua has started in our heart, how are we going to see God when he's hiding from us at this time of the year? Well, here's the key. Kislev is understood to be a month of the year in which God may be hiding, but he is inviting us to find him even in that hiding place. Any good player of hide and seek knows you want to hide, but you don't want to hide so deeply and craftily that no one could ever find you, right? That's no fun. Really, the point of hide and seek is to enjoy the pleasure of hunting and finding in the end. This is a time when it's specially possible to see God between the lines, to see him in the depths and the secrets of the Torah, to see him in the deeper patterns and hidden places, and for that to fire our hearts for him. The word Kislev is thought to be two ideas joined together. The first part of the word kes refers to covering or concealing. The second part is the lamed vav, is the idea of twining or uniting, lava. And it sounds, by the way, just like the word for heart, lev, in the word kislev, which is spelled with a bet instead of a vav. But putting the two together, we can come up with the interpretation of being twined together through what is concealed. Okay, being twined together through what is concealed. When we see God in the hidden places, our heart is entwined with his, and there's a real power there for us to act. Rabbi Aaron Raskin paraphrases Rabbi Schneerson, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, as explaining the meaning of Kislev as this: that which is concealed, alluding to the higher realities of God, the hidden dimension of godliness, this now becomes revealed to every individual. Kislev is known as the month of dreams, and we read many dreams in the Torah portions during this month, right? We're about to read about Joseph and Joseph's story. What does this have to do with anything? It's called the month of dreams, but I would call it the month of the interpretation of dreams. You see, God has put us into a dream, like the movie The Matrix, or what C.S. Lewis describes as the Shadowlands. Okay, he put us in a dream here. And he says, read between the lines. Read between the lines of the world I've given to you. And look at the code itself, which is Scripture. Because buried in the code, you will find my heart, the heart of your Creator. You will see me in the dream. Kislev is also the ninth month. And the number nine is associated with truth. It's the number of truth. So this is a time to dive to the spiritual root, the truth behind the veil of the physical. So what happens when we actually see God? Our hearts get fixed on him, and we get set in the way that leads to relationship with him, and we will not be deterred from that way. By seeing God in these hidden places at this time, The flame that the Messiah has sparked into being in our lower bodies during Tishrei, the new covenant, is fanned into a roaring fire within us. The heart wants to see in this way. And once it does, our emotions and our even deeper instincts become engaged for him. So in this way, history witnesses this scene. Mattathias, the priest, was called to assemble with his sons and the rest of his family and the rest of the city of Modi'in, right? So this is the Hanukkah, beginning of the Hanukkah story. This is chapter 2 of that book. Once everyone was gathered, the Greek official said to him, "You are a leader among these people. You be the first to make a sacrifice to the Greek gods." And Mattathias looked at him, seeing the vast power of the Greek Empire supporting him, and he said, "No, I'm not doing it. I and my sons and my brothers will continue to live by the covenant of our ancestors." Rather than making that sacrifice, he ends up killing that Greek official and changing his life forever, right? They flee to the hills. They're hiding. They left everything behind. And it also sees him leading a successful rebellion against Greek humanism. So why would he do that? What was the power behind that act of defiance? The text says, now I know this isn't scripture. This is the book of the Maccabees. You know, it's not scripture, but we can think of it as historical record anyway. So the text there says that Mattathias burned with zeal and his heart was stirred and he gave vent to his righteous anger. He was zealous like Phinehas was for the Lord. And the result was powerful, righteous action to slay the enemy that wants to turn us cold for the Lord. What is our part in this seeing process? We are not going to see God in between the lines of the Torah if we're not first seeing the visible lines of the Torah. So we need to be in it. We need to do the work of being in it, and not only that, but meditating on it. This is the time of year when this investment of time and mental energy will yield great results. Take advantage of it. Knowing the seasons is one thing, but knowing the seasons and using that information to your advantage is something else. Meditate doesn't mean you have to sit cross-legged while you're humming and burning incense. For me, I do my best thinking when I'm writing, typing at a computer, or even manipulating images in a PowerPoint. Do whatever it takes for you to be able to spend time with the Word and ask Him to open it up to you, to speak to you through it, to help you see between the lines. Kislev is especially the season for him to help us in this. Pray that God would open your eyes and trust that he will. So let me bring this discussion around to our situation now at Beth Tikkun. God wants to give Beth Tikkun a little fire in the belly right now, and we do well to reach out and grab hold of it. We have recently been through what we can only assume is a cleansing process, and that's tough. But now that we're seeing who we are moving forward, now that our identity is beginning to swim into focus a bit more clearly, it's time to get excited for what he's doing. I recently went back and watched several teachings that are some of our earliest videos on the Beth Tikkun YouTube channel, in which Grant and Steve were explaining home fellowships. And Grant in particular was answering a bunch of questions. You can go back and find them by just clicking on videos on the Beth Tikkun YouTube site and scrolling down to near the bottom. The titles are The Great Kahal, Keeping Your Cool While Walking Through Fire, and Here We Grow. These are all from January 2021. After writing out most of this teaching, I went back and reviewed the second video for the first time just yesterday, Keeping Your Cool While Walking Through Fire. And it really confirmed for me what I had written out to share with you, what I'm hearing that God would speak to Beth Tikkun right now. For one thing, I was surprised to hear him mentioning the month of Kislev over and over in the teaching. And this is because Kislev is mentioned over and over in the book of Haggai. And in that second teaching of the three, Grant compares Beth Tikkun's situation to the book of Haggai. One thing he notes, just by the way, as an aside, is that not everyone wanted to leave Babylon and journey back to reestablish Israel. Only some did. There were some who were comfortable where they were and who continued on there in a foreign land. I'm sure they did a lot of good there, and yet they dropped out of the center of the story of Israel. We don't really hear from them anymore. But another thing he explains in that teaching, and this is mainly why I bring up this teaching, is that a couple years previous, he had started to notice a change at BT, which he described as a softening of zeal. He was quick to say that he considered himself, to be the one responsible for that failing that he saw, that loss of zeal in the body. He said he was failing to communicate to especially newer people the spirit of Beth Tikkun. And he went on to explain that God was orchestrating events in the world that would help Beth Tikkun to right the ship. Of course, he was recording when COVID still had everything shut down, and he was live streaming from the ministry center because we had lost Riverside. I don't think personally that Grant failed to communicate the spirit of Beth Tikkun to newer people. There's simply a growth pattern, a salvation pattern that the body of believers goes through in the same way that individuals do and in the same way that the world goes through. There's a blessing, and the blessing leads to a fattening and a dulling and a falling and a repentance and a cleansing and a trimming and a new fire is brought forth again. Okay, it's all part of a process. And that new fire eventually becomes visible from the outside, and it attracts others. And that's what Hanukkah is partly about, the Hanukkah in the window, and we grow again, right? That Hanukkah in the window is an evangelistic tool, and it's inviting people into the warmth and the light inside of our homes. So let's get ready for that. Let's get excited to grow again. Let's prepare now to grow again. Let's ask God to show us the people we need to invite in. Again, the way we tap into this stoking of the flame right now is simply by doing what we do, which is to be in the Torah and trust that he is going to allow himself to be seen there in a fresh and invigorating way. And pray with me that God would lead us to the right people that he has prepared for Beth Tikkun. Pray with us that prayer. We can't bring life from the dead. We can't quicken our own hearts, but we can do the little he asks us to do, which is to just make the space for him to work within. So let's talk now about the Torah portions, Vayetze and Vayishlach. In Vayetze and Vayishlach, we read the bulk of Jacob's story, the dream of the ladder, his time in Haran, acquiring wives and more wives, and making a family, his wrestling with the angel of God at Peniel, his reacquaintance with Esau, the chapter with Dinah in Shechem, a second encounter with God at Bethel, and finally the birth of Benjamin and the death and burial of Rachel. Let me just touch on a few points of connection between this discussion of the calendar and these portions. First, notice that Jacob is headed north. What does that have to do with anything? He's headed north at the beginning of these portions, and we are to see this as a kind of exile. And this period of exile is like the fall and winter, right? We're celebrating Hanukkah and Purim on this half of the calendar. These both occur within the context of exile. So exile is associated with winter. The north is associated with the left, the physical, darkness, and cold. All right, so let me repeat that. The north is associated with the left, the physical, darkness, and cold. These are all themes we've been talking about for the fall and winter. Jacob is having a winter experience in the north, and it ends with him taking a step higher spiritually. He does, how does his exile end? It ends with the reconciliation with Esau and a second encounter with God at Bethel. In the same way, when we come through the winter, when we come to the other side, he lifts us to a higher level. God officially changes his name to Israel there at Bethel, the second Bethel. Although the angel had foretold this change a little bit earlier in the story. And interestingly, now that Jacob is at this higher level of Israel, right, he's given the name Israel, one of his wives, Rachel, is no longer suited to him. So God takes her away. The fruit of their lives together continues on in the form of Joseph and Benjamin, right? Three tribes, two from Joseph and Benjamin. But Rachel herself is somehow not a part of this next phase of Jacob's development. Note that Rachel is not buried with Jacob at Hebron, but Leah is. So my point here is that in having this exile experience and coming through to the other side, this winter experience, Jacob is completing a cycle and then being elevated to a higher level, which is associated with a new name and even a new situation among his wives. So my second point has to do with the dream of the ladder. This is maybe the first of the dreams we will read in the Torah in the month of Kislev, this month of seeing through the dream. Grant points out in his discussion with Robin on this portion, which he recently posted on his website last week, that the word behold or see keeps getting repeated in the story of the ladder four times. And Grant sees a progression in those four beholds. This is a dream about seeing God, literally. And part of the dream is that God appears at the top of the ladder. Secondly, regarding the dream, notice that he's dreaming about a ladder that connects two realms, the physical below and the spiritual above. And we've learned today that our own bodies have this same below and above picture, our lower body being the world below and our head being the world above. In a way, Jacob is seeing his own being in the dream, his own body with a world below and a world above. In John, Yeshua basically says that he is Jacob's ladder that connects the two. So what does that mean for us? That means that it is Yeshua who is the one that connects together our head and our heart. How does he do this? By mediating the new covenant, which is the Torah written on the lower body. So we can see in this ladder a picture of what we're talking about the new covenant. The ladder is Yeshua. Yeshua brings the new covenant. So a third connection here revolves around this question. Why was Isaac, right, Jacob's father, why was Isaac not strong enough to return to Haran to find a bride, but Jacob was? Jacob is allowed to go back, encouraged to go back even. But regarding Jacob's father, Isaac, Abraham tells his servant, whatever you do, don't take my son back there. You see, Jacob represents a later stage of maturity. Jacob is somehow stronger than his father, and that is the way it should be in a certain sense. We're talking about a progressive relationship with God that goes upward and upward. Jacob represents someone who is filled with a fire in his belly. Esau was apathetic to the birthright, but Jacob wanted it. Jacob was willing to risk his father's wrath to gain the blessing. Jacob is born with a kind of passion that it seems was not quite awakened yet for his father, Isaac. And so this is the source of Jacob's strength. His strength is this passion that he's born with. He's able to go to Haran when Isaac is not. Let me make one final connection to the season and to the second portion here. This odd and troubling chapter with Dinah. Here is how I think we are to read this chapter. It is a test of assimilation, a test of being absorbed into another culture that the family passes, although they do it not in an especially kosher way, with Simeon and Levi basically killing a whole town, right? So that's not the way you're supposed to avoid assimilation, but, not recommended. But the point is that they did avoid the assimilation. So let me draw some quick connections through the names here. If it goes by quickly, just rewind it and listen again. So Shechem is the prince who rapes Dinah, and his father is Hamor. So Hamor means donkey, and the donkey is a picture of the material world, which is Chomer. So they're from the same root, right? Material world and donkey. Shechem is the sun. Shechem is the upper back and the neck. So right here, the place where you bear a yoke. The offer from this Canaanite people to Jacob and his family is to be yoked through Shechem to Hamor, the material world, Homer. What is being offered to Jacob in this chapter is the chance to become one with an earthy Canaanite people. This is exactly what is hanging in the air in this season of Hanukkah, which is a story about resisting assimilation into the humanist, material-oriented world, the Greek culture of the time. So this is a battle that is mostly happening within us right now, although there may be some outward pressure on us too, right? The society might be pushing on us, but mostly this is a battle that's happening inside of us. For the most part, though, we need to be on guard internally in this season, and we need to resist the push to make compromises with the world that join us to the world, whatever that means for you. So notice that this is a kind of final test for Jacob before God calls him back to Bethel and lifts him higher. He and his family passed the test and they got promoted. I know that's a rather different take on that messy chapter, but it's something to think about anyway, particularly since we read it at this time of year leading up to Hanukkah. So let's move to Joshua now, Joshua chapter 3. The first part of the story of the crossing of the Jordan. I'd like to make a point here about this generation that enters the land. These were giants. This generation didn't mess around. They took down giants in the land, one after the next. How were they able to do this? First, let's recognize that this generation, like Jacob, is representing a latter stage of the salvation pattern. This generation is the second half of the story of the Exodus. And this is why Joshua is a great study for the second half of the year, the winter side of the year. God has already invested a lot in teaching Israel, and they have grown spiritually. He has spent 40 years under Moses forging them into a fist. They came out of Egypt as a ragtag, downtrodden, scrappy collection of ex-slaves. God carefully taught them everything about how to be a people, starting with giving them the Torah, his rules for life. Even in how they march and camp, God is teaching them order and kedusha, holiness, and their elevated status. He disciplines them after the golden calf, then brings them together in such a beautiful and humble way to build an absolute jewel, the tabernacle, over the course of the first winter out of Egypt. And the tabernacle is set up for the first time on Nisan 1. They're learning right from the beginning the kind of unity and fruitfulness that comes through brokenness and humility and obedience and wholeheartedness. They have learned how to listen to him in their movements by watching the cloud, and they're learning how faithfully he provides with the manna. They have learned that they could count on his provision and protection. So this is point number one, that this generation represents a later stage of the salvation pattern. Secondly, this is a generation filled with passion because they have seen God. In their case, they are seeing him more directly than we do, since we are much farther down the line and he is more hidden for later generations until he's not, right? Until he shows himself to us. And maybe that's coming soon. But the principle is still there. This was a generation that was totally sold out to God because they had seen him. And part of that seeing is happening right here in this miraculous chapter. The drying up of the river is a bit more hidden than the crossing of the sea, but it's an obvious miracle nonetheless, in which God is helping to fix their hearts on him. But even before they see this sight, they're already sold out. Listen to this answer from the eastern tribes when Joshua checks in with them from chapter 1, even before they cross over. They say to Joshua, "All that you have commanded us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your commandment and disobeys your words whatever you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. Right? So that was from Joshua 1. The Bible is telling us here, these people are committed, right? And they are passionate to follow God wherever he is leading through Joshua, as he did through Moses. Then they cross, and then they attack Jericho with another rather extravagant miracle, right? These giant walls come tumbling down. Again, God is taking no chances. He's showing himself to his people, and he will do the same for us. It's just a little more hidden for us further down the line. Well, and it worked. Let me read one more verse from the last chapter of Joshua, chapter 24, almost the last verses of the entire book. And it reads like this. After these things, Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in his own inheritance at Timnath-Serah. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel, right? The ones who lived during Joshua's time and the ones who had seen what the Lord had done in coming out of Egypt and coming into the land, they stayed faithful to God and to his covenant, right? Their hearts were fixed because they had seen God. This generation was fixed on the goal until the end, because they had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel. And the word used there is they had known, right? There's a process of knowing and relationship that all of this results in. What we're after is relationship with God. Lastly, let's make a couple of connections to Yeshua here. We've mentioned him along the way here. As the minister of the new covenant, it is through his blood that the Torah is placed in the gut and written on the heart, the lower body, the engaging of the emotions for Torah, the flaming into passion. This is why the new covenant has the power to not be broken, unlike the Mosaic covenant. Remember that the pathway to consistent action has to eventually go through the emotions, the passion. Under Moses, at Shavuot, we see the Torah sort of landing in the mind, the upper world. There has to be a falling with that and a repentance before we realize that we lack the power to do the Torah consistently. So that's what Shavuot and the 3 weeks and repentance of Tishrei are all about. Yeshua was not just the messenger, but also the message. And he shows us that proper balance of head and heart. We see him capable of coldly and shrewdly maneuvering around the traps set for him. Right? They try to trick him all the time, and he can just, using his intellect, just get right around. He knows his Torah, too. Yeshua is an intellectual giant. But we also see Yeshua in the heat of righteous anger, and we see him cry. We see him passionate for the plight of humanity in Jerusalem. We even see him, you know, in the garden sweating blood because of his passion. It is a passion that seems that sees him through what we call the passion, right? We have a section of his life which we call the passion, which is his death and resurrection. So the passion that he has gets him through that, going to the cross. Lastly here, if we zoom out to the entire breadth of human history, we see that Yeshua comes just a little past the middle of the 6,000 years of human history before the seventh millennium. Which is different, right? That seventh millennium is different. Yeshua comes at the equivalent of Sukkot in human history, just a little past the middle of the 6,000 years. And it is right about then that God is beginning to open our eyes to see him in a new way, to see him between the lines, right? All of this between the lines stuff, seeing God, is happening a little past the middle is when it's starting. Yeshua is God between the lines, right? Yeshua is God showing himself to humanity so that the human heart can be forever changed, fixed on him, engaged with passion toward him and his ways for those who have the eyes to see. Right? Yeshua is a God in physical form. We see him, we see God. And that moves our hearts, and that fixes our hearts. for him. And humanity has changed from that point on because we have seen God. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you for listening. May each of you be blessed with a growing inner warmth in this season of increasing cold. And may he make us into the people he wants us to be. Shalom.